Tonight, it's my great pleasure, with some delay, it's my great pleasure to welcome Lilith Strand and William von Holst to speak about Heavens and Hells of the Mind. They are both students of spiritual teacher Imre Valjean. And as you see, there are a number of both recorded but mostly printed works for them to talk about tonight. We're very grateful that they've decided to join us here tonight, from as far away as Canada, in fact. And so thank you for coming, and thank you, Lilla and William, for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you. And I actually want to thank everybody for coming out on a dark, cold night. But at least it's not snowing. And I want to thank the bookstore for the opportunity, because it's a very wonderful feeling in here. And when I read about the tea things and the different things happening, I thought, oh, I'd like to come to that. But that won't happen. Anyways, this evening, William and I will share talking for maybe an hour, and then we will have questions, and I will endeavor to intersperse my talk with a little bit of readings, and I hope I'm still struggling to get it just right, because sometimes I feel like, oh, I didn't read anything, or oh, I read too much, and I'm still trying to find just a good balance, just so that you can get a sense of the book. And then after we've had questions, then we can look and pick up free things and look at the books or shop or whatever. So you already heard a little bit about Imre. He was born in Hungary, in 1940, so he was 69. Judith asked how old he was. And he's a very remarkable person who actually is born different from most human beings, in that he had already a continuous consciousness. He had already the interior knowledge and realization from the inner worlds. And even as a very young child, he had quite remarkable experiences and, you know, struggled and stretched himself to manage them as a small child. And he always carried a destiny. He always felt that he was had a mission, and one of the missions actually was that he wanted to show that all the religions were one. And he actually felt that he had this impulse that at the very first time I met him, he talked about this five-pointed star, and that basically was the English speaking. It was England, Canada, the United States, Australia, and New Zealand, and that was the countries that he was going to awaken up. And he knew that he couldn't stay in Hungary, and he had a hair-raising escape from Hungary when he was about 15. Left his family and everything behind, and believed that he was on his way to the United States. And on some ferry boat somewhere, some mysterious elderly gentleman came up and said to him, your destiny is in New Zealand, which he couldn't believe, because he was on his way and he had applied to come into the United States. But actually the United States rejected him, and he was accepted by New Zealand, and so there he went. And he started teaching really, I guess, publicly in a way when he was about 19. And, you know, like speaking at Theosophical Society and speaking at yoga things. And then at a certain point, he actually had this feeling about that he was going to gather a group and really work to bring transformation and to bring the teaching into a reality. And so he's been carrying on with that for 25 to 30 years. He part of the knowledge that he was just inherently born with that he has is mantric knowledge. So that if he hears a mantra or he looks at a mantra, like even just say Om, he can feel, he knows the reality of what that energy is on the inner planes and what that would do for you if you announced it and meditated on it. And this is, it's an amazing feat when you actually read the book and you see his mantric knowledge in Arabic and in Hebrew and in Sanskrit and he just knows them. He's not had any training in them. He just knows that that's what it is. And when he writes or speaks, he's actually speaking like from truth or from revelation. So it is not like a mind giving a coherent or like logical, or it's not like a rational mind kind of thing. Although he speaks very coherently, I don't mean that. But he wrote, the material that is in these books has taken 16 years, not 16 years nonstop, but 16 years for the editor to actually put into a more coherent, more easily readable flow for us. So, and the editor who worked on it really had an amazing time working daily with this high frequency material. You know, that how he could just, he would just be buzzing with the light and had a hard time actually some of the time because it would just be hard to stay grounded. This book was actually meant to be one book, and I remember at a time that the editor, his name is Phil Carter, gave me a proof of the one book. But Imre kept needing that because he felt that this was kind of like a scripture for the beginning of the Aquarian Age on, like for the next few centuries, that it is a total guide, an inner guide for humanity. He really felt that he wanted it to be quite complete, and so it kind of grew, and in the end it turned into four volumes, but it is still thought of as one book. Because he's in New Zealand, the first award the book won. Was okay. I'll just keep going like that. I guess it likes me. The first award came from New Zealand, and it is called the Ashton Wiley Award. And that award has to do with the book that the judges deemed to have the most possibility of helping humanity come to a better consciousness and a better place. It also won the Living Now Award in the United States last year. And I think I would just like to read to you his dedication, which tells us why he is motivated to write this book. And this is what he says. I dedicate this book to the aspiring soul of humanity across the planet. We are one planet, one humanity, one life, one God, one reality. May this book help you to recover your own lost wisdom and knowledge of your real self and the knowledge of the real God, the bright eternal self that is the truth, the love, and your own cosmic life. Beautiful words, very inspiring. So to help us do this, to regain our own true selves and our own wisdom and all that, the book is divided into, there's four volumes, as you can see, and the first one is knowledge. It's called knowledge. And when Imre teaches, he always both if he's writing or if he's speaking, he always goes from cosmology, that means from the whole, and then he brings it to you as a human being, how it concerns you. So his first, the first part of the book is dealing with cosmology, which is understanding the greater worlds and the greater parts of ourselves that at this moment we are not registering. We are kind of trapped in our bodies by our senses and by a body mechanism that somehow has lost touch with the ability just to access the inner worlds. So the first part will have different charts and things similar to this one where he will try, I don't know if you're familiar with this or not, but he'll usually, the lower part here, sometimes called the three worlds, is designating the physical plane, the astral plane, which is also the emotional plane or the plane of desires, and it is also, in the large sense, the place where people first go after they have died. And then there's the mental plane, the plane of thoughts. And basically, within that world, we are limited and stuck and keep having the same ruts in the road, and we actually have been reincarnating for a long time on this planet. I remember him saying to us once, I think somebody said, oh, so-and-so is an old soul. He says, old soul? He says, you are all old souls. You've been here thousands of times doing the same thing, you know, over and over again. And in all that role, we have played different roles and so on. So for some reason, there has happened in the process of humanity a kind of a gap in consciousness where we, our physical eyes and our physical ears and the frequency of our body is very good at dealing with the physical plane, with this plane. It was made so that we could do that. But somehow we have become disattuned to the finer vibrations. And so in that way we have a handicap. And unless we do something about it, we will keep staying that way. We actually have to do something. And if we don't know what to do, or we don't have a vision of what is possible for us or who we really are, this is how this book starts out. Who are we? we can't regain anything if we don't know. We can't get to New York if we don't know how we're going to get there or what's the goal. So this is the book of knowledge, where he wants to lay it out so that you can understand what it all is, what you are, what is possible, what is beyond the part that you're registering now. And he goes from that, and as the book goes on, it starts becoming more pertaining to you. There's fabulous chapters on karma and about, I forget what they all are, but it becomes down to more the human level and how everything is for what we experience here. And the second book is the book where he takes six streams of the ancient, all the religions that have been on the planet. I better look and see what they were, just so I can tell you. One of them is yoga, like it starts with Patanjali Sutras. Pure Christianity, the religion of love. Zen, the path of enlightenment. Sufi meditations, the way of the holy fire. Tantra, the path of relationship. And the warrior school, the way of the noble warrior. So six streams that have been on the planet for since ancient times. And it's not like scholarly discourse or research or arguing about things. It's actually entering. What he does is he takes his consciousness inside those religions to the impulse that the consciousness that first started them. And he puts you inside that path so that anybody who really loved you know, Zen or loved Christianity could actually just enter into the real essence of the path, the inspiration of that path. It's a very beautiful, beautiful. And in this book is where you see that, yes, in their essence, they're all saying the same thing. You know, there is just the one God, and we all want to reclaim our true beingness. And then the book three, which is the book I have with many little tabs in it, is the book called Transformation. And that is really where he is showing six paths that are very suitable for this age, because we are in the age of Aquarius and we are a modern society and we are different than we were 2,000 years ago. Not in that we're trapped, we're still trapped in a material sense. And when I say trapped, I don't mean that, oh, this is bad and we somehow have to escape from it. It's not that. It's just that we are meant to be the crowning glory of God. The true angels, which are kind of different from maybe angel books that you see, they're actually our consciousnesses that are angelic in nature. And they span different planes, but they don't have physical bodies. We are the only beings that were somehow created to have this full constitution so that we could be creators right on the planet. And we do. We create. And sometimes we create big messes, as we are. But it isn't that, oh, this is not a good place. This is meant to be a very good place. But we are just meant to have full consciousness. So that's the path of transformation that is shown in this book. He has the first part is called The Path of Return. Very, very beautiful, beautiful, clear account of how we return to full consciousness. The way of the heart, he always has a very big emphasis on awakening the heart chakra so that we can experience, instead of, which is different, awakening the heart chakra and coming to transform divinity is not the same as trying to be more loving or trying. It's actually about being in a state of oneness where you are at one and it is the experienced reality. It's a glory. So there's a big emphasis on the heart, and that is one whole path in here. The way of spiritual psychology, which is a very, very clear and wonderful path also for the modern world, because it is taking an approach that approaches kind of from, it's about us. It's about us and our consciousness and our minds and our emotions and how to start managing those better, getting them more a little under control, and so that we are moving in the direction of the vertical evolution, so that we come to greater consciousness. In this book also, the worship of the goddess, which is another thing that Imre really tries to do on the planet, is to reclaim what he calls the eternal feminine, that the Western religions have kind of suppressed the feminine, and what he wants really is for both men and women to understand what the true feminine really is, and that there is a feminine nature of nurturing and tenderness and caring and beauty and exquisiteness that is actually a part of the whole divine consciousness. It kind of stands right from here, right up, and it is it's much more than what is sometimes thought of as, oh, the goddess, as in paganism or something. It's actually the feminine, the female side of God as he. There's also God as she, although the nature is quite different. The nature in the feminine of God, if you want to call it that, it's a different nature and purpose than what is the purpose of God as he. They're just like they're male and female is very, actually very different. I think our society tries to make them the same, but they aren't the same, and they have a different function. The yoga of the sun, which has to do with actually the solar logos, and then the way of service.
So I think I have something to read. I think I will read you the stages. This is, you know, often when we are in a place of everything going how we want it, it's great. But on this planet, we certainly, I'm sure, have all stumbled and come into great pain and difficulty, and we may really wonder what it's all about and what can we do. And so I sometimes have really felt at those times, like, well, why isn't there not a map or, you know, a tabulation of all the karmas I have to pay off so I know? And in this book, just on this page, is just four stages of the work, four stages of awakening that we from the place where we awaken and come to a much larger livingness and reality and love and bliss. And this first stage is at the very beginning, before we awaken, the energy of the self, and when he says self, it's like the soul, the energy of the self manifests outwardly on the physical plane. The self becomes identified with the coverings, that's our bodies, and the outside environment. Service is to the personality, to the material well-being. So at first, we are very busy, always outward, serving ourselves, basically. The second stage, an adjustment period wherein karmas are worked out. The self is identified neither entirely with the outside nor entirely with itself. This is a period of troubles, struggle, opposites, duality, turmoil, and strife. Attempts are made at consciousness transference to the self. That is, we are trying to transfer or allow a greater consciousness to come in, but it doesn't always happen. We just try. We're trying this through meditation. Transmutative forces are generated in the personality. So we're trying to transmute things and get rid of baggage and go on. Now, so that's a time when you might be having a lot of things to deal with and you wonder, why is all this happening to me when I'm actually on the path and I'm being very good? But actually, we have karmas that do have to be worked out. So then the third stage is the consciousness is centered in the self being in the soul, which is past this little gap here, and you start, what's actually happening is you're refining your frequency so that you're starting to register some of the impulses that come from the soul. The self is realized to be different from the personality. Conscious efforts are made towards group service and world service, spiritual life, and self-realization. And then the last one is actually you identify with the divine life and cosmic service. So that's quite a long path that takes, is not the first. Coming to cosmic service is something way up here when we finally become Buddhas and Christs, but that's actually what our whole destiny of humanity is, to wake up to what our true beingness is. So, I just want to say something about knowledge, which is the first book of knowledge, to realize that knowledge is not the same as information. We live in a society that is totally drowning us in information. We can have more than we can ever make use of, and we can keep our minds busy with it at all times. But knowledge is something that actually carries like a light frequency. It is something that affects our consciousness. So that when we gain true knowledge, our minds and our thinking processes become clarified because our consciousness changes. And consciousness actually determines our reality. It determines our life and how we make choices and how we can consciously evolve our life. So that is a very important part of reading this book, is that it will give you this kind of knowledge. And it isn't just, I mean, sometimes it seems like, oh my gosh, that's, you know, heavy reading. It isn't. It's actually very light reading. There is great inspiration and light that fills you when you read this book. I think I'll just...
Could you tell us a little bit about how you engaged the material that when you became first aware of it and how it spoke to you?
With this? Or...
With Imre Valliant's work. I mean, how did you encounter it? What happened to you?
Well, you know what? It is... It's actually been like 20, 25 years. And it... I have to say that when I started off, I actually, looking back now, I didn't really understand the whole process, and I didn't... It's just a process of... I find now, having access to such clear material as this, I think that that we were kind of slowish learners at the time. I can't really answer how it was, because I, you know, it's something where you keep trying.
Did you see the book somewhere? Did you meet the man?
No, I met him, and then I proceeded to work with him and go to retreats and workshops for the next 25 years. And then we had classes always, and there wasn't material like this, but we had at first tapes of him speaking, and we would have classes, and he would do a lot of the processes that are in the book three, where he actually, book three is a place where I'm telling you about how he prescribes, he suggests paths for this Aquarian age. He has many meditation techniques in them, although there are same meditation techniques and things in book one and book two as well, but in book three he really tries to make the path. So we would meet and have classes, and we would keep trying to do the things he told us to do. And it just over a period of time, everything happens. Just, you know, you work out your karmas, you become clarified. Slowly, my attention became more inward. And as the attention becomes more inward and not always out, I think I would say I was the kind of person that was always very, very over busy. So that if you create an over busy life, then you have an over busy mind. And then it's even harder to become inward and still your mind. Because actually the world you create and live in is just a reflection of yourself, what's inside you. And so I think gradually I managed to recreate, to change my life so that I could become more inward. And when you actually develop the stillness and inwardness inside yourself is when you actually can start moving. Imre has, moving your consciousness and what he's talking about, transferring consciousness. So if you are still inside yourself and you have increased your frequency enough, called down the light, called down this light, your awareness starts stretching, you start registering other things, you start becoming aware of either light in the head or awakening of heat and love in your heart. And it just is a process that... Sometimes he used to tell us, like, that we're way too impatient and that we think this is something that's going to happen instantly. And he's saying, like, if you thought you were going to become a concert violinist or an astrophysicist, you would accept that it's going to take a little bit of time. And if you compare your thousands of life that you have ingrained yourself in the physical world and in the ego, the separated ego, then you will realize that it's going to take a little bit of time. It's not like an instant pill you can take, you know, or push a button. You have to have time to disentangle yourself and to develop the inwardness and to work out the karmas, which actually are, karmas are not so much necessarily something you have to pay back, but it might be something that is an inner adjustment inside you of a pattern or a way of dealing with things. There's just, there are inner adjustments that have to be made so that you become just clear. But I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, it tells me more about your experience with it. That's what I was really
interested
in. Right,
okay, all right, yeah. Okay, I think maybe William would like to say something.
Thank you.
Yes.
Water time.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all for coming. And Leela and I have this knack of saying the exact same thing in completely different ways. So what I would like to speak about tonight is turning inward. And throughout the day, as I was sort of feeling this kind of energy, it was like turning inward. Oh, that's much too difficult. I can never even begin to describe what it means to turn inward. Because there's not a single word that I could say that would help you understand it. There's not a single rational thought that could help you understand what I mean by turning inward. Because the bitch of living on this planet Earth is that the rational brain is never going to get anything spiritual. The rational brain, the way we interact with the world, is so separative. We come into this world, you know, I said last night to these, you know, these two university kids, you know, really bright kids, right? And, you know, they're focusing very much on philosophies and, you know, huge cosmology and kind of the history of consciousness. And I was explaining to them, you know, you come into this world, you're turned upside down, you're smacked on the ass, and your beautiful soul-like consciousness that was present at that moment is just shattered. And all of a sudden your attention is focused on A, pain. You're screaming, and when that first scream comes, there's breath. You've never experienced breath before. All you get is, you know, whatever that fluid stuff you get inside the, you know, the room. It's not air. It's something else. So it's like there's this shock of consciousness, and it literally, the soul is just in this absolutely blissful unity, love, joy experience. You know, it's immortal. I mean, your soul is immortal. But then you're thrown into a body, you're turned upside down, you're smacked on the ass, and all of a sudden you're feeling pain, you're pissed off, you cry, you're cold, you got slime all over you, and that's the beginning of your little experience here on Earth. And then, you know, you kind of like go along, you're a little child, and everything seems really sweet, and you're taught all these things. And it seems, it's so odd, because everything that you're taught is outside of you. It's outside, it's not within you, it's outside of you. You know, you begin to discover that this chair, is not inside you. The chair is out there. And if you want it, have you ever seen like the age is probably like 6 to 12 months. You know, they're in their mom's arms or their dad's arms, and they're always like, you know, like their whole being like points, but it's pointing to something that its understanding is not. They don't have it. So they're pointing in their consciousness that they want it, and it's out there. So they're trying to, like, they don't have words, they have no way to communicate, their little being is somehow, candy. You know, and, but it's, you just see the whole little consciousness like struggling to communicate that that's what they want. So you begin to get conditioned, and you're conditioned, and you're conditioned, and you're conditioned, and you're, you know, you live with parents who are completely conditioned, you know, that everything that's real is outside of yourself. And then you get into language, and then you begin to, like, I want that candy, you know, or candy, you know. You like, begin to discover ways of, you know, getting what you want. But it's like, constantly what is happening is that your consciousness is getting split. Your focus is getting split, becomes very focused up here. And your, you know, that experience of the soul of just being connected to everything, it becomes less and less and less, and then your focus goes outward more and more and more. so that you, you know, as adults, most adults, somehow everything is registered through your thinking brain. Every experience you have, somehow it gets all caught up in how you think about it. You know, you could be walking, you know, in the Tetons, gorgeous mountains, and your mind is commenting about how beautiful the snow is. You know, it's the brain is interacting with what it's seeing. You're not standing there experiencing, feeling the incredible beauty of those mountains. Your brain is commenting on mountains. And then you start communicating to people, and you think somehow you're communicating a thought, and that's telling something real to somebody else. So it's like we're kind of thrown into this world, and it's so disconnected to who you really are. And then, you know, you come to a little event in a little store in, you know, a little town, and there's this funny-looking person in a blue shirt who's going to stand before you and say that if you are able to turn inward, and if you are able to really understand what that means, you can actually begin to experience the world in a completely different way. But the difficult thing is that the rational brain can't turn inward. The rational brain can only think its thoughts. So then, and this is the you know, the great difficulty of every major religion, is because they try to describe God, they try to describe the burning heart, they try to describe, you know, divinity and all these kinds of words, but what it's trying to do is to help you understand what it means to turn inward. So that process of turning inward is like taking the bulls from the horn, you know, like struggling with the bull. You know, you're wrestling with every single energy on this planet, wanting to turn inward, thinking you can turn inward, you can't. There's no way that any one of us thinking can turn inward. So then we're stuck with, okay, I want to be on a spiritual path. I want to, you know, become conscious. I want to, you know, experience life, you know, the way all these beautiful teachers experience it, but I'm not. So what happens at that point, and as, you know, Leela was describing, each of these books, there's a path about the heart. And what the path about the heart is that literally what happens is that your focus, that outward connection, can be turned around and literally dropped, so that your focus, your attention can be dropped into your heart. And in that turning around, as you begin to drop your awareness, what happens is that the heart begins to perform incredible mysteries. The deepest mystery on this planet is a journey that you will take from your head to your heart. There is no journey anywhere in this universe that is as mysterious and as powerful as a journey that you can take when you begin to understand that your head is limited, that your thoughts are limited, and you realize that you have to do something about that. And then when you begin to make that that journey begins when you're able to literally kind of drop and to move into the mysteries of the heart. And Emery says that in the heart there are seven chambers. In the heart there is the jewel in the lotus. In the heart there is a pearl of great price. In the heart there's a stone that the builders forgot. And what all these are implying is that actually buried within your, and not your physical, not your pumping little heart, because your pumping little heart is just basically physical body kind of stuff, but in your energy field, there are layers and layers within your heart. And the true spiritual journey is when you are able to move and begin to discover those mysteries within the heart. And You know, I've been to answer your question about experiences with Emery. And Emery starts talking about the mysteries in the heart. It's like you, my whole being. You know, she said earlier her toes are really excited. But it's like, oh, that's it. He's talking about the mystery of mysteries. Mm-hmm. If you can understand that journey from the head to the heart, then with and actually begin to experience the heart energy, there are, well, in the essence of it, the jewel and the lotus, Om Mani Padme Hum, means that within the innermost chamber of your heart, there is a teeny little jewel, and it's actually a piece of God. It is God itself. It is coming from this, you know, this is all very complicated and heady, but it actually comes, well, actually comes from the monad. It is a piece of the monad. It is a brilliant piece of God itself. And in every single human being, that peace dwells within our being. It's not on the physical plane. It's not on the astral plane. And this is a real kicker, because it's even not on your soul. It's not on the soul level. It doesn't exist. Your soul lives in these eternal realms. It's blissful. It's happy. It incarnates every time. You know, you get turned upside down periodically. You get slapped on the ass. You experience life. You die, usually like horrible death. You know, you go through big dramas, you die. And that sometimes you go through dramas your whole life. But anyway, you're just going through, and you just over and over and over and over again. But the kicker is that even your soul can't do it. Your soul can't grab this divine spark. It can only grab, or it can only touch the divine spark when you actually are in physical incarnation. So the soul itself cannot tune into that divine spark. The soul can only, when it's incarnated into a human being, into the physical plane, go through this process, drop from the head into the heart. And when you begin to touch that jewel in the heart, this divine spark illuminates the soul so that it becomes radiant and present here on the planet. A being like a Christ who, you know, radiated love, was a being who illuminated within his heart the Father and transformed his whole physical being into a radiating soul, radiating God. And the task is that every single one of us at some point in time is going to do it. It could be in another 10,000 lives. Or it could be in this life. And if you seriously want to try it in this life, I suggest you don't do it by yourself. It's basically impossible. Because what is needed, and this is what's so beautiful about being with Emery, to answer your question about what you experience with Emery, is that being with him, you begin to understand the process. And you feel his energy field, and he is radiating from his heart. And so when he stands in front of us, we feel, not in our brains, but as we become more and more sensitive inwardly, we begin to feel this radiating presence. So when we do a meditation together, it's like we're being helped in this process of this huge journey from the head to the heart. And what's so beautiful is that he's actually has all this actually out to help people like us teach others. So this whole process, this whole mystery of this head to the heart can be revealed to many people. And what this transformation is that it's a transformation that when someone can do it within their own being, that transformation helps the planet through its crisis. As you all know, this Earth is in a horrible state. There's enormous kind of things going on. disasters and wars and earthquakes and just, you know, and it's going to get worse. You know, it's just we're in a crisis point. And the only, we can do our part, and our part is to start the journey, and our part is to really become conscious within, to step on the path, to find someone that can truly help you in that journey. So, questions?
Where is the place of grace in your system, in its model?
Grace is the experience of love in the heart. And grace is divinity. This incredibly divine being, loving all of us, loving all of his creatures. And in spite of all the suffering that we go through, and in spite of all the dramas and the miscarriages of life, there's that point when you know, and it's usually you might have that in your life. There's some crisis that comes up, or some moment where you feel like an impulse to do something, you know, just like to change. It's like in that moment you are receiving an enormous amount of grace. You are receiving an enormous amount of help from invisible realms that help you on your journey.
I'd actually like to add something to that,
which is that, you know, how we all have an observer inside us. There is a point that watches. It's inside you. You yourself are watching yourself. A lot of times that watcher becomes lost in busyness or drama, or you went shopping and you realize, oh my gosh, I haven't been paying attention at all, I haven't been conscious for hours now. Well, that witness part of us, believe it or not, is actually part of the higher planes. It is like when you are in your witness mode and you stop willing and doing and driving and wanting, I mean driving yourself, you surrender. When you surrender, when you come to yourself and see yourself and you are just still and surrendered, that is the moment that actually grace or spirit can get a hold of you. And it actually, I think I have something on the back. There's actually this, I just draw this point right there, that's the little watcher person. Because that little watcher is actually a very divine thing. It's actually very special. The more you can observe yourself, how you're doing your life and how what it is that you're thinking about or taking you out, away from the observer, it's very important. We have often sat and done meditations where Emery says, okay, this is very difficult. I just want you to sit and be. And watch what is happening inside you, but don't engage. And it's actually, if you try this for a few weeks, you actually start realizing what it is that catches up your mind all the time, what it is that you always want to, what are your favorite things to think about all the time. You know, you have them sitting there. And you can start seeing what kind of unloading you might do that would benefit yourself. But that watcher person is very special. That little point inside you that is aware and witnessing your life. Because that is consciousness. And it's not actually part of this world. It's a very small little speck. But that is a door opening. There's actually always grace. The call is always going out. Grace is ever present. But humanity is mostly too busy. But when you are in the watcher, in the witness, you're available.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you will register grace at that moment, but there is way more chance, you know, because it's an act. What's very difficult is that our ego, our sense of our separated self, has exercised for thousands of life that it needs to exercise itself. It needs to go forth and grab things and do and arrange things for itself. Well, you can't arrange enlightenment. You can't demand that grace will come, or that your soul will descend into your being, or that the Logos is going to pay attention to you, or that you're so special that you should already be enlightened now. And we have to somehow learn to immobilize ourselves, which is what William is saying, well, actually, we can't do it. But we can. And part of it is invoking the higher energy and realizing it and experiencing the higher energy, whether it is from a teacher or it actually is encapsulated in this book. You read this book with the right mood and reverence. I don't read it, you can read it like a novel, of course. I read the whole thing the first time like a novel because I want to know everything that is in it. But even so, when I came to that book with the special mood or the special reverence, it's like I was swimming in light. You know, it actually carries an inspiration that goes into you that is grace. It's very amazing. So, the rational mind cannot turn inward, but you can learn to be in the watcher and to learn, just observe yourself. It's such a, it's hard for us to believe that to be in the observer is one of the most important things for you to actually start regaining your inner stature and glory. Yes?
Would the two of you talk about sounding light?
Sounding light? Well, sounding light. You mean sounding light?
Yeah.
Not. Okay, our publishing company is called Sounding Light. So we're actually here representing our publishing company. Sounding Light. This is something very amazing. Maybe William after wants to talk about Sounding Light. When you say Sounding Light, this quote from this little piece that Imre has written that is about the name of God and the names, and I was intrigued by that, the name and the names. And what he said is something that I don't know, but this is what Imre knows by experience. He says, many are the names of God, one is the name. The sacred science of the divine names has been known and forgotten and revived again and again in all the major religions. The name of God, the Word, the Logos, is an outpouring of immeasurable spiritual power, glory, brightness and radiance, sound and light, cosmic vibration. The name of God is all-pervading within you and all around you, within every part and particle of creation. It is one, indivisible, invisible. It is invincible power and life force. It cannot be spoken or uttered by any human tongue, not in Sanskrit, Hebrew, Arabic, Greek, Latin, Persian, or Chinese, nor in any other human language. The names are names of God in human sacred languages. They can be uttered and pronounced and sung and chanted and meditated upon. But the name, the radiant divine emanation,
can only be seen with the eyes of the soul and heard with the inner spiritual ears. The name can be heard within the heart as sweet heavenly music and in the head as the cosmic ocean of creative rumbling word or power, the ocean tide of life. The names are used to call upon God to connect you to the divine word. Or maybe you would like to say something about sounding light.
I just find when I read that, I think, oh my gosh.
That's a big question. And when you go inward, there's everything is glorifying God. And in that glorification, the true angels, not the fluffy New Age angels, but the true angelic glorious beings, are singing to God. And in their glorious singing to God, there is light. So the light and sound are the same. And it is all just an enormous symphony of sound and glory. And what we're not doing on this planet is we're not singing with it. We are not participating in that glorious symphony. We are doing just the opposite. And the sounds, the vibrations of this planet are horrible, absolutely positively horrible. Turn on the news, you know, listen to some music. It's just the vibration, it's just hideous kind of noise. And the thing that's so tragic is that each of us with this voice can sing the most exquisitely beautiful sounds. And what we do in this work and is that, you know, there's 100, 150, 200 people sitting together, and we sing. And all these chants are composed within a group. They're all mantras that Emery has given out. And they're all new. We don't practice them. We just start off, and this is new chant. But what we are doing is we are singing a sound to God. We are trying to get the vibration of the planet, which is so dense, so that in that sound, that it begins to lift the vibration of this planet. And that's part of that whole sounding light. Because when we do sing, and there's this, and you can just feel it in the air, you can feel, I mean, it's just absolutely magical. You can feel the you know, this beautiful, our beautiful voices coming together. It doesn't always happen, trust me. But I mean, but when it does happen, there's this descendance of light. I mean, it literally, the whole group, you can just inwardly just feel like this descent of enormous light. So it's like we're participating in that sounding light. And that energy is the energy that will transform this planet. You know, when all of humanity sings that song, when all of humanity sings to God, sings together divine harmony, you know, this planet will become a planet of light. It will no longer be this hideous fighting, you know, Terminator kind of existence. It will be, you know, an imaginable world, an incredibly beautiful imaginable world. Any other questions?
Now, what if a child is born into the world and is not spanked and is not traumatized and has a peaceful existence until a culture that is softer and more gentle and more rewarding? How would the path of that child be different than the path of a traumatized child in terms of the chain?
That child's very fortunate. That child is truly fortunate, and I'm going to tear it up in a moment, but I saw a child like that yesterday, and it was in a field, this little bookstore in San Francisco, and there were very few people there. We really described it earlier, and these two young boys, they were 23, came into the room, and they were the most spiritually radiant beings I have seen. And I just I just looked at them and I was stunned and I was tongue-tied. And I just sat there and I was so in awe of these young boys just came in and they sat down. And what was so incredible about these two boys is they sat there and they were so present. Lila was talking and I was just watching, they were so present. Their whole consciousness was listening to what Lila was saying. They weren't like, they were present. They were there. And what happened was a miracle, because there's a part of me that has longed to see a child like that on this planet. And I saw one yesterday. And when I got up to speak, my heart, all I wanted to do was to embrace them. You know, I mean, to help them. And what we witnessed was that there's this incredible light and energy came into the room, and the whole room became enveloped and held all of us. And you know, I don't know what I said. I have no idea what I said, but I, you know, just spoke to them, and it was so beautiful. And I had no idea, you know, who these kids were. They were just, you know, they sat down, and at the end they came up to us, and they were so present, and they said, you know, we're students at the California Institute of Integral Studies, and we're in the master's program, and we're studying consciousness
and transformation.
And I talked about transformation the whole time, and it's like I'm still in a way recovering from what happened last night, because it was just so incredibly magical. So yes, there is. And I think Lila and I have been just so ecstatic all day, because we're realizing there's a new generation coming into this planet that is going to get this planet through its transition point. Enrique's talking about this as transition point, where the planet's either going to go into an incredible darkness, like a Terminator kind of hideous war state, mental vibration, or it's going to move into a planet of light. And he's basically giving us, like, 2025 or so, we have this critical point before the planet's going to do one or the other. And I spoke to these kids about that, and they understood it. They knew exactly what it is. And, you know, I said to them, you are the ones that are going to move the planet. It's not going to be our generation. It's your generation that's going to change this planet. And they understood it. So, you know, we, unfortunately, have had a rougher road. We've gone through a pretty dense planet. You know, we were born in World War II in communist Hungary. We had a hideous childhood, a vibration of violence and, you know, horrible, you know, things as a child that he witnessed. So, you know, it's like our struggle, I mean, hopefully our struggle will help the new generation with a foundation of truth that they can begin to really change this planet.
So did these two young boys, did they have the gentle birth, or did they have the gentle, I mean, what created?
I think that William's metaphor for what happens when you're born is very wonderful for the purpose of explaining how we all turn outward. But, you know, that greeting into the world is not going to determine consciousness and soul quality. I would say, yes, it's so ideal for a child to have this kind of a beginning and whatever kind of childhood. But, I mean, Imre had a horrible beginning to life. I mean, he might have, I don't know if he was smacked or not, but I'm just saying as William says, that he had a life of war and hunger and deprivation, and you know, somehow we seem to get what it is we need to become the greatness of who we are, and it's actually our soul that determines these things. And you know, I mean, I have seen, we all know of children who have had the most lovely and gentle of everything that that actually turned out quite perversely different from that. Mm-hmm. But generally, of course, the more loving and tender and lovely their upbringing is, and somehow we'd have to assume that karmically their soul calls for that since they're getting it. Mm-hmm. But there's also amazing, amazing human beings and warriors and lovers of humanity and servers of humanity that have come through the most hellish conditions. Mm-hmm. So,
I'd like it if you could pick out another passage to read that speaks to Imre's uniqueness in his vision.
Oh, yeah, he doesn't talk about himself.
No, no. Not his own circle, but something that is unique in his vision, not about himself.
I see. In his vision. I don't think I can... I think to speak about the uniqueness of his vision, I have to...
No, just some topic.
Okay, so I can find some topic.
That is not... That stands apart from, say, other teachers, or stands apart from other traditions or something, that is uniquely his own interpretation or vision.
I don't know that I can find that. I mean, I can just open the book, but I don't know that will be. That's a very unusual request. I think it's very beautiful. but I have to just, I can read you something, and I also want to say that one thing that I have always found very unique and wonderful in his teaching compared to things I've done before is his absolute acceptance, his love and his total acceptance of everything as it is, and teaching you to accept yourself exactly how you are, and to accept the world how it is, and then do something with the handicap that we have here, which is to do the practices to regain that inner love and oneness. And the new path particularly that he is speaking about is actually just this, he really emphasizes that this is not bad. This is not bad. This is good. It was not created, you know, like this was not created by an evil, different God. This was the same God. If we are here, we're meant to be here. We're not meant to escape away and go and sit in a cave or be in a nunnery. We're actually meant to be here and be active in the world and to serve the planet and serve each other and serve God. But, I like this. This is beautiful, but I don't know that it's different, because there are very many true teachers. I think what is very different about Imre is that he combines these very living practices. Like he has one of the segments, if you check out our Planetary Transformation website, he emphasizes these four ways of transforming yourself and coming to the full stature of your being. And one part of that is physical, it's called physical reconditioning, which basically is just bringing full awareness into the physical plane. But his path that he uses to help you do that is called the path of the spiritual warrior. And that has everything to do with attaining
the highest consciousness in love and acting out of that higher consciousness to bless the planet and to bring the goodness and the light into the planet so that it doesn't become that Terminator quality or whatever it's called. But that's a very wonderful thing because it has this physical aspect that involves like calligraphy and runes, and which are runes actually. He uses the ancient Hungarian runes that can be done with a sword, which is where you just use a bamboo stick. But that is actually a discipline to your physical body and making you become aware of the life force and the etheric energy that, so that you're bringing conscious of, basically he wants to bring conscious awareness into each of these planes, your personality parts, and lift up the vibration of each so that you can become more connected with, more receptive to the inner realities. And so we do these calligraphy things, and we do, the exciting thing about using a sword stick to do runes is that runes on this level, to do it with a bamboo stick, for instance, it actually carves into the etheric energy a symbol that actually is connected to the inner worlds in the same way as a mantra is. It's a very wonderful practice. And then on this plane, we always do chanting, worshipping, what William was talking about in the sacred languages, which is just very ecstatic to express this kind of love and devotion. And then on the mental plane, he really advocates that you study the sacred signs to clarify your mind. And the last thing that always is emphasized is meditation. And to sometimes to help you meditate, just using a mantra repetitively, intoning it to call down the light. Because the more we are calling down the light into our being, the more we are able to receive the impressions of it. If we do nothing towards the divine, well, we're just going to keep staying in our same state. But I like this, and I think it's very beautiful and inspiring, so I will read it. To the degree that you focus on the great invisible, to that degree will your experience of life change. The totality of the universe, the whole, the world, is greater than what you see with your physical eyes, and it is surrounding you always. All the planes of being are simultaneously existent everywhere, all of the time. And invisible hosts of beings surround you on the invisible planes like fish encompassed by the ocean. Samsara, which is painful existence in Sanskrit, is coexistent in space with nirvana, beatific bliss. And between them are all the shades of dimensions, from pains to joys, hells to heavens, all simultaneously in the one mind. The totality of you is greater than your body, brain, mind can imagine. The vastness of your mind, the splendor of your soul, and the brilliance of the Father within you cannot be within. The brilliance of the Father within you cannot be understood by the brain mind. You are always your totality, body, mind, soul, and spirit. But you choose to focus in body life only. You can choose to focus in your mind, and then a new pattern of life will open up for you. You can even choose to focus on the soul levels of life. That is radical change. Then there is communion with the spirit. Whenever you focus your attention, your awareness, that is what you experience. Thus, if you want it, you can experience infinitude. Wherever you focus your attention, there you are. There was something else. I guess it's gone. I like this one here. It's called All This. All This. The one, is transcendental and absolute, timeless and eternal, boundless and measureless. The one is also the limited, the temporal, the relative, the conditioned, this world and the next, heaven and hell, the gods, angels and men, the animals, the plants, the rocks, things visible and invisible, important and trivial, life and death, eternity and reincarnation, all is the one.
I have a question on
yes.
there for you.
Yes.
I've been kind of lingering with it.
Okay.
Wonderful. What is the relationship between the one and what you've been calling God?
No, the one is God. God, see, God is a difficult, is it that, God is a, God comes from, the word God comes to us out of churches and other sacred texts, and we might have very different ideas of the word God. But when I'm using the word God, there basically is, there is the part that is timeless and still and eternal and is full of consciousness and full of, but it's still, it is all one. It's intelligence, omniscience. It's like a consciousness and a life force that pervades everything. And it is, when it comes, as it comes down the planes and it densifies, it also separates itself into many separated little things. But in each thing is the life force, is that little piece of God that is in our heart. So there is basically traditionally an immanent God, that's the indwelling God, that is the spirit spark and life force in every created thing. And then there is the timeless consciousness, the absolute. So we actually can worship just the little piece of God actually within our heart to awaken it.
Well, when you speak of the specificity of
yeah.
God in that way, it leads me to believe that what is not mentioned as God is not considered God. But some of your words seem to imply that it's all God.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'm getting the reading, oh, but God is saying that something else, that there something else is whatever. And so I just wanted to clarify that. So the bottom line, it cuts through all of it, is that everything is God.
Everything is God. Everything is God. Absolutely.
And the most amazing thing is that the space between you and I is God as well.
Whether we imagine it,
no.
perceive
no.
it, or not.
No, God is
yeah,
right here.
Whether we perceive it or not.
I'm saying that's
yeah.
true regardless of what we think about it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
but in terms of we perceive the world only in terms of how our perceptions are working. So we don't have the perception to feel God right here.
Mm-hmm.
But but we are being trained in the school to have the perceptions to feel God right here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's getting close to 9. I think we should probably wrap this up.
You didn't talk about book 4?
No, I didn't talk about book 4 this time. Book 4 is a lexicon. It's a little bit smaller than the others. The more I read in this book, the more helpful I find the lexicon. There is a very... there's a detailed table of contents that goes through everything that is in all of the books. Sometimes I just open it and I just think, oh my gosh, I want to read about the cosmic Christ that's on this page, or I want to read about the Vedic life, or whatever catches my eye. then comes a little explanation of why he uses Sanskrit and what Sanskrit is and something about that. And then comes a wonderful, wonderful lexicon where he will explain what the terms are, mostly Sanskrit, but there's also Arabic and other things. I just used it today to look up Atman. I just wanted to know what really was Atman, which is up on one of these planes, I forget which one. And then it has a wonderful index that is in alphabetical order, and you can just look things up that you want to know about, and you can just find them in alphabetical order. So, I think we're done. Thank you for your patience and questions and your interest. We have books to look at here. We have Christopher has printed up the Planetary website and Sounding Light website. There is also a page in case you would like to be in contact with us for any reason, study groups or workshops or whatever here. We have got a beautiful card that has both the school website and the Sunday Light website in case you might want to look things up. On Saturday we are doing a workshop in Santa Cruz. It's probably very far for you. It's on this card, free bookmark. And if you have any further things, comments, or things to say, we'll be hanging around. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, those of you who know the drill know the drill. We have a donation bowl there on the counter. We encourage you to contribute to it to help maintain the space so these sorts of events can happen in the store and to help support the work of our guests. So thank you so much for coming tonight. We look forward to seeing you again in many rooms. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we talk about different levels of angel, I mean, spirits, and what we can say that we're the 10th in the spiritual hierarchies.
I think he calls us the fourth, but he says there are 12 creative hierarchies.
Thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you.
And,
time and your
yeah, I think probably somewhere he puts us, but I can't recall right now. So you're a Steiner student also?
Exactly.
Yeah, I have a little quite a lot. I studied that before. And still, you know, it's
did
very,
just kind
very
of show
beautiful.
Up in
well,
your
it
life?
Sounds like they're both.
No, it's not in Canada.
Yeah.
It's called the Netflix. You have to come to it. And I'm going to
yes.
retreat and something.
Whatever the word is, the realms are as real to them as
yeah.
far as.
Yeah, I think that when Steiner wrote, he didn't actually have as much hope for us because he was actually saying that we could get to Devashan. Which is the highest
yeah, it's,
world.
It's, you know, it's a joy to have all, you know, that we've been working with this for 28 years.
We would come to what he called consciousness soul, but he didn't think we could do it in his time.
Well, we sure haven't done it.
We're actually making good progress compared to, yes.
It's oh, I thought, by the way, just for feedback, I thought it was very useful for you to point out the difference.
Oh.
Because it's a worship.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very thick thing that most of us can relate
exactly.
to.
Exactly.
So, and of course, it once you lose that, then you have no longer you're usually committed about something.
Exactly. You're lost again.
Yeah. So it's a very nice little valuable.
It is, I love that. You know, it's such an easy way just to start right where you are, to just observe yourself and observe as often as you are conscious, to observe your mind, observe your life,
and witness what is going on in your life. It's a wonderful first change. I don't know what they are in Canada. You'd have to just ask him over there. The chanting CDs are very, very beautiful, and they have a little booklet with what the meanings are. One is actually to the solar logos. That's the yellow one, and the other one is to the Divine Mother.
And are the groups basically in the
No, the groups at this moment are, they're actually England. He never ever could get anything going in England, not even one, not even nothing. He tried many times, but huge response in Germany and Holland and Switzerland and Hungary. Pardon?
I got it from over
here. And we have groups in New Zealand, of course, and Australia and Canada. And we have small groups in Sacramento and William in San Francisco.